I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Mother's Day is around the corner. Find the perfect gift for the mom in your life with a stunning piece of jewelry from Blue Nile. From timeless pearls to dazzling gemstones, Blue Nile has something she'll adore. Need it fast? Most items can ship overnight. Plus, enjoy guaranteed free shipping and returns. Don't miss our special Mother's Day deals. Save big on the season's most beautiful trends. For a limited time, get up to 50% off by going to BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Hello and welcome to Lore Watch, a roundtable freeform discussion about lore and the games of Blizzard Entertainment. I'm Ann Stickney, one of two lore-focused writers from Blizzard Watch, and I've got both of my wonderful co-hosts with me today. First up, he's our other lore-focused columnist over on Blizzard Watch, and that would be Matt Rossi. Hey, Rossi, how's it going?
Hello, everyone. How is it going? I don't know. Welcome to podcast.
Welcome to podcast. Our second co-host is also here as well. He knows his shaman and he knows his lore, and his name is Joe Perez. Hey, Joe.
Hey.
How's it going?
I'm looking forward to today because we're going to be talking about a topic that's probably going to make my dog excited, as it usually does.
your dog, yeah, because we're talking about the character who your dog is namesake to, and that would be Sylvanas Windrunner. I know we're probably, you know, a little late talking about this, but honestly, we do the show like every other week,
and we have so much to talk about. There's only so many hours in a day.
Yeah, we had these two things come out at once. We had the Anduin stuff that we talked about with the last episode, and then we had the short story. And I really wanted to get Anduin out of the way and talk about him because I thought that he was kind of a fascinating character. But I also want to address this too. There was a new short story that came out. We weren't expecting a short story, I don't think. It just sort of dropped, and it's called Dark Mirror by Steve Denuser, and I really hope that I am pronouncing his name correctly. I've never heard it pronounced before. He's one of the lore people, one of the big lore people over there, one of the big creative development people over there at Blizzard on World of Warcraft, and the story Dark Mirror is one that I wanted, but I didn't know that I wanted. It involves Nathanos Maris, a.k.a. the Blightcaller, who got a model update in Legion. A big model update. He's no longer this default male Forsaken model. He's actually got a character model. Well, I thought that was great and everything because, you know, he has like a slightly larger role in Legion. What we didn't know is that there is actually a lore reason for that change, and it was explained in the story. So I guess really if we want to start here, we should start by talking about who Nathanos Maris is, who he was when he was alive. Rossi, do you want to start with that?
Well, sure, okay. Nathanos Maris was the only human ranger lord when the Farstriders were going concern under the High Elves. They were being led by the Ranger General, who at the time was Sylvanas Windrunner. She had inherited the position from her mother. It wasn't always an inherited position. It was just that it happened. She was, all the Windrunner sisters were like in the running to take it. Basically, it was kind of like, yeah, the best Rangers we have are all Windrunners. Okay. Illyria, you want it? No. Okay. Sylvanas, you want it? I suppose. So,
sure,
yeah,
Sylvanas. Why not?
Sylvanas was, you know, the Ranger General. At the time, the High Elves and the human kingdom of Lordaeron were, like, bordering and sort of kind of warily trying to get along. And Nathanos basically went up and through his own abilities earned a position among them, which was extremely rare. The High Elves never really viewed humans as equals. Like, they were useful, but, you know, you don't really want to get too close to them. So Sylvanas letting a human even in the Far Striders, much less become a Ranger Lord, was unprecedented. Nathanos was a big deal among humans because, as I said, he was the only human to ever do it. No other human ever even got into the Far Striders, much less became a Ranger Lord. And as a result, when the Third War came around and the Scourge broke out all over our Lordaeron, and Nathanos died fighting, you know, trying to save his home, and was raised from, you know, he became one of the Scourge. Sylvanas basically went looking for him, and that's part of the story, so I don't want to go into too much more detail. Let's just say he was a big deal before he died. He was like a symbol of humanity's ability. Like, a lot of people viewed him as a kind of a, I don't want to say a culture hero, but I can't think of what else the word you'd use for it. He was, you know, a sign that humans belonged in Lordaeron, that they were, you know, it was, they could do anything. They could even become rangers in the, you know, big high elf organization. So after his death, when he came back as the Blightcaller, he became Sylvanas's champion. And this was a huge problem for, like, the people in Stormwind, who, a lot of whom were refugees from Lordaeron, and, you know, for King Varian, even before Varian. In fact, when you do the original quest, it was Bolvar who freaked out over this. Even Bolvar was like, no, not Maris, not Nathanos Maris. Nobody in human wanted to hear that the Blightcaller existed. They didn't want to hear that the once great champion of their people was now this monster.
Keep in mind, I'm going to jump in here.
No,
keep
go
in
ahead.
Mind that Nathanos was extraordinary among humankind because his abilities as an archer, as a ranger, were
as a tactical a tactician,
yeah,
as well.
Yeah.
Like, don't forget that part.
They yeah, he wasn't just so, a shooter. He was
they
the
were
Lord.
So yeah. much more than human, though, that they were on par with this race of creatures who had developed this, and it was almost like an art form at this point. It's sort of like, gosh, I don't know if there's an equivalent, really.
Well, let me put it this way. Let's put it this way. Nathanos was so good that he could boast credibly to the Ranger General that he was a better shot than Lorthmar Theron or Haldoran Brightblade.
And he could back it
up. Accurate. It wasn't. Yeah. It wasn't just an idle boast. It was accurate.
He could back that up.
He was saying this like, let them. If they have a problem with me, let's go. Now, to put that into perspective, I think the only person in the Far Striders at the time who was better than the two people I just mentioned all had Windrunner in their name. One of whom he was talking to, and. Of archers on Azeroth, I think the only two who you can really say are better than them are Lady Vash and Chandra's Feathermoon, who are much older.
They're all probably pretty on par with each other.
Yeah. He's putting himself in league with some of people who've been around for thousands of years.
And he's just
in the
human
span
dude.
Of the, he's yeah, a, in the span he's of a human lifetime.
He's a surly human dude, so he's done it, and he's gotten to that level in a fraction of the time that it took any of the Windrunners
yeah.
or Lorthmar Theron or even, you know, Chandra's Feathermoon.
Even the youngest Windrunner sister, Varisa, who is not quite as good as Sylvanas, she's good, very good, but not quite as good as Sylvanas, took hundreds of years to get there.
And this guy did it in, you yeah. know...
Maybe
10,
maybe even
20.
Just 10 by that time. Yeah, this is not.
I don't remember how old he was. Like, there's not right. really. There's no.
It's implied
set...
that he's at least in his 30s, but
yeah, there's no real like set date for Nathanos to have become a ranger. Nor is there an age assigned for when he died. It's just yeah. he died during the Third War defending his home.
When he was alive, when he was at the height of his powers, he was old enough to have a like. Nephew in like the early 10 to 12 years old.
Yeah.
But that's not, you know, he could have been 25.
It's not much of
himself.
An indicator though.
Yeah, we don't know much, but we do know that Nathanos was such a big deal that the Alliance basically sent up an army to kill him. I know, cause I was in it. And we went up there and we tried doing it and it wasn't easy and it didn't even matter. Like, we did it and he just got back up.
Yeah. Like, the whole reason that people were so horrified, though, was because this guy was a big deal among mm-hmm. human among humanity, he had it, kind of, he was like there, an Olympian or something like that, you know, only it, beyond it was, that.
I'd say it would be like finding out that, to use an example, so finding out that Gavin Rad the Dyer was a Death Knight, or finding out that, you know, Uther had become a Tauren. Although that one would different, would just be like, what?
Everybody would just be like, what?
Hi, guys, I'm a Tauren now.
No, Uther had become a warlock. That would be...
Yeah, okay, that's more like it. Uther's a Tauren would just confuse everyone. Where's he at? Uther's now, and now I'm on Team Evil. Gul'dan's my bro. What? Okay. Well, yeah. So, yeah, that's Nathanos in a nutshell. I feel like we've covered who he was.
Okay. Joe, do you have anything to add to that?
Just that from the Horde side of things, especially after he died and risen, there were some interesting things before the Alliance tried to murderate his face. Like, he would send adventurers to go get weird things of like, elven and human artifact origin, so to speak, like the Quel'Thalas Registry, things like that. And it was interesting, too, because not only was he requesting these things, but he was looking for new and interesting ways to destroy the elves that once tormented him in life. And I thought that was kind of just a cool little touch, even back in the vanilla days. That was just... That's entirely what I envision. Like, you spend your entire life being told you're not good enough, even though you are. Then you get a second chance at unlife. Well, time to go murder some people. Like, it was just, it fits so perfectly. Like, I don't know why that sticks with me, but I remember, like, going to get him things. And in the meantime, he's like, okay, I'm going to go over here now because there's some elves, and I'm going to go rip off their ears and see what happens.
I think what stuck out to me the most about Nathanos was how surly he was. Like, he was downright surly. It didn't matter that you were there to do favors for him. You were beneath him, and he treated you as such. And
well, I mean, we were.
Yeah, technically speaking, yeah, you were. Because, I mean, look at who he was at the height of his humanity. When he died, he did not die fighting in Kel'Thalas or anything like that. He died out there on the Maristead, defending his home.
Against Ramsan the Gorger, right?
When he was raised, he, like every other scourge that was raised, had no real memory of their humanity. When you're raised a scourge, it's just you're kind of like this mindless creature that's under the control of the Lich King, and all you know is what the Lich King tells you to do, what the commands tell you to do. And most of the time, that involves killing. A lot of killing. A lot of killing. To make more scourge. And then you go and you kill more things. Sylvanas broke free because there was that kind of wavering moment where the Lich King lost control. And it was just enough of a moment that Sylvanas could break free. And so did a lot of people in Lordaeron. Nathanos wasn't one of those people. He wasn't one of those, that original group of Forsaken. Sylvanas went to him very deliberately and snapped him out of it. And they talk about that in Darkmere. They actually go into detail about that particular part of his story. Because he's got no awareness of who he is until Sylvanas shows up and says his name. At which point, he snaps out of it. Which, not only is it kind of interesting that Sylvanas would go to, you know, Nathanos, out of everybody, she immediately thinks to go to Nathanos. She's like, I need a champion. This guy will do it. But she's powerful enough to break what remained of the Lich King's hold over him, just with her voice.
I think that's twofold, though, because, like, not only is it the power of her command, as the story dictates, as it lays out, it's the power of their interaction in the past, the relationship that they've had as well.
Let's talk about that, because it's pretty obvious here that Sylvanas, I mean, she made Nathanos champion. She made Nathanos a Ranger Lord because he had the ability and the skill and everything else, right?
She was his teacher.
Yeah.
She was the one that trained him in the ways of the elven combat. Like,
beyond that, beyond that.
Are you guys going to keep dancing around this? Or are we
no,
just
we
gonna
are.
Say, oh, no. I want to, like, that.
I'm sitting there going, you go guys ahead. Are kind of pussy it transitioned, here.
It transitioned from her being the teacher to very obviously them being lovers. Like, it's right there. It is plain as day. And
they pretty much spell it out here in the story. Yeah. And it's never been spelled out quite as plainly as it is right here.
And it makes sense, right?
My wife's exact statement was, unless your last name is Murdoch, you don't get to identify a person by their smell when they're, like, way behind
yep.
you.
Yep.
You know, that's something you only do if you've smelled it a lot. The story is pretty blatant. Two people were lovers.
And it fills in a gap that we've all, I shouldn't say we all, but a lot of people have assumed for years, because why would she come back to look for a lowly human risen? Why would she come back? Why would she go through all this trouble for one?
Well,
because
he was the Ranger Lord, and that makes sense. He was really even powerful, so that makes sense. But this just adds another dimension to that, I think.
It's the icing on the cake. It fills in the last gaps, right?
And here's the fun part. Apparently, if you're a Windrunner, you're destined to get with a human, is what I'm gathering.
Yeah,
we got Alaria, Taralion, we've got Varisa and Ronan, and now we've got Sylvanas and Nathanos.
I'm going to say this. One of the things I thought when I first read the story, and I even remember writing, I wish my dog would shut up outside. One of the things I remember writing when I was writing the queue about it, the day after it dropped, was that it kind of makes sense that the Windrunners would look outside their people, because the Windrunner name is, like, right up there with, like, Sunstrider in terms of what it means in what that was then High Elven and what is now Blood Elven society.
It's like a dynasty.
Yeah, it's a big deal. The fact that the only remaining Windrunner is still a High Elf, it's kind of a sign that the Blood Elves are never really going to heal. They're never going to completely to come back from what the Lich King did to them. And that, you know, it makes sense that they wouldn't, because it's a huge deal. But at the time, when they were, like, kids and growing up, the Windrunners, you know, all of them, including Lirath, like the dead brother, and all the various cousins and so forth who died, they would have known that their family legacy dates back to coming across with Dathramar. The very first Farstrider Ranger General was a Windrunner. Thasdora, the Windrunner bow, has been, you know, the symbol of Quel'Thalas as much as anything, as much as Quel'Dalar. It was, you know, the pressure on them is enormous. You're told from birth, essentially, your life isn't yours. You're not going to be a normal normal elf. You're not going to, not for you. You're not going to get to go and pursue magic, and, you know, because you have a job. You know, you were born with a destiny, and that destiny is to protect your people. And you can see how each of them was affected by it in different ways. Varisa is kind of the rebel, where she's like, no, I want to go out and find my own destiny. Illyria is more like, well, if that's my destiny, fine, then I'm going to do it, but I'm going to do it my way. I'm not going to be the Ranger General, because that's too much. I would take away from what I'm good at. I'm better at the actual going out and killing than I am at telling people what to do. And then you have Sylvanas, who's her entire life, the entire time Sylvanas was alive, she was duty obsessed, to the exception of pretty much everything else. Like, she didn't have the typical life. If you look at the High Elf, the way High Elf lives went, she didn't have it. She was Ranger General from a fairly early age, and, you know, had her mother kind of sitting there watching her as she took over. Her mother resigned before she, you know, her mother wasn't Ranger General anymore before she died. And that means Sylvanas basically had this legend watching her do it. And then Illyria there too, also watching her do it. Illyria, who everyone thought was going to be Ranger General. So there's a lot of pressure on them. So I kind of understand why they might look outside of High Elves. And the thing about humans is, for all their various faults, they don't give a rat's ass about Quel'Thalas.
Or the politics they're in, right?
Yeah, they don't. Yeah, what does Nathanos care about? You know, Haldoran obviously had his eyes on Sylvanas. So did Kael'thas. That's stated.
Oh, yeah.
Kael'thas,
and it's,
you know,
and it's not out of love either. It's like there's a lot of
politics.
Political motivation. Yeah, exactly.
It's domestic, you know. If you're a Sunstrider, who are you going to marry? Well, the Windrunners are good enough. Like, you know, there's only so many families in Quel'Thalas that you could even think about marrying, and the Windrunners are one of them. That's why I think you see the three Windrunner sisters all kind of rebel in their own way, and they all kind of rebel with the group that's the closest and yet furthest away from them. Humans are, closer but farther away.
One of the lines in the story actually kind of reinforces that. And it made me laugh when I read it, too, because Nathanos was talking to Sylvanas, and this was a flashback sequence. And Sylvanas said, Lorthmar says you hide yourself away because you're intimidated by elven archers. And he says, flat out, he says, Lorthmar Theron is a fool. He's better suited to politics than the life of a ranger. He uses politics as an insult. Not only does he use politics as an insult, but it's actually become this kind of self-fulfilling prophecy, because what is Lorthmar Theron doing right now?
Politics, yeah.
And he hates it.
It's interesting, like, so the Windrunners, you kind of have that setup where not only are they, is a lot expected of them, but they're just plain, I don't want to say better, but as a family, like, it's almost like they're, even the worst of them is a hero of the classical sense. They're going to do things and transcend everything that anyone else could possibly do. Like you mentioned with Sylvanas breaking the Lich King's control and breaking it not only for herself, but breaking it for Nathanos. Or Varisa, who basically restarts the Rangers, or Illyria, who goes off to hunt the orcs single-handedly. They're like, it's a lot for other people to live up to as well. So again, it makes sense that you'd want to be with someone who doesn't think about it, who isn't intimidated by your last name, who isn't intimidated by what you do, because they don't really know. They don't really understand. It's not an issue for them. I don't know. That's just my take on it.
It makes it kind of interesting, because the dynamic between the two of them is interesting, and it kind of transcended even after death. I mean, like I said, she went to him specifically to break him from the Lich King's thrall and bring him back to her side to serve as her champion. And that's who he was when we ran into him in Vanilla. He was the Blightcaller. He was Nathanos Blightcaller, champion of the Banshee Queen, if I remember right, was his title. And when you went to fight him, you went to fight him with a full raid of people, and you needed to fight him with a full raid of people if you had any hope of bringing him down.
People often brought two raids.
He was one raid to fight him,
and one raid to fight the other guys.
One raid to fight him, and one raid to basically deflect the Horde. Because the thing about Nathanos Blightcaller, because he was a Horde NPC, attacking him as Alliance meant that you were flagged for PvP.
Yep.
And it didn't matter what kind of realm you were on, it was just the act of attacking an NPC from the opposite faction. So Horde would show up to try and ruin these attempts, and you would end up, you'd be fighting Blightcaller, who was a powerhouse in and of himself. You couldn't solo the Blightcaller. You couldn't even take like a 5-man group and 5-man the Blightcaller. You needed the raid. You needed like the full contingent of people.
I think people were finally 5-manning him in Wrath.
Yeah.
Like, and
it took
even then
to
it was
about then.
Yeah. Around level 80, people could take him with 5 people.
You had to have a blood DK back then too, because he would just one shot a tank otherwise.
Yeah. It was pretty crazy. And that's just kind of a reflection of just how powerful this guy was. But even though this guy was powerful, even though he had a unique name and obviously a unique title, and he was in service to the Banshee Queen, he still had that same Forsaken, male Forsaken model that everybody else had. He had a slightly different outfit, but he had the same... He looked like a Forsaken. He looked like your standard Forsaken.
Run-of-the-mill Forsaken, yeah.
Run-of-the-mill Forsaken. In Legion, he's got a new model, and he looks a lot more human, and he looks a lot more like Sylvanas, really. He's looks like an actual human being with all of his body parts in place. He even has facial hair.
And the red eyes.
He's got the red eyes, he's got the pallid skin, and he looks kind of like a mirror image of Sylvanas. There was a reason for that. Sylvanas had a ritual that she wanted done specifically for Nathanos. Now, I this part kind of struck me as really interesting, because she figured out somewhere along the line that the Valkyr could perform this ritual that would essentially revitalize a Forsaken and keep them from rotting away.
Well, she even mentions in the story that it's akin to what happened to her. Like, when she completed her duty, or felt that she completed her duty and flung herself from the top of the spires, that when she was brought back, it was the same thing that she underwent, essentially, that she was informed that could be done to others.
It's pretty, it's pretty much almost identical to what they do to Death Knights. And the fact that it's the Valkyr doing it pretty much cements it. It's the Death Knight ritual.
It is. And I mean, it's similar to a lot of other things as well, which we may get into later. But what strikes me about it, too, is not only is this something that she has theoretically undergone, all of the Dark Rangers have the same aesthetic, which means every single one of the Dark Rangers had to go through this ritual as well, because they're not typical Forsaken. They look like just like Sylvanas does, an elf that has been preserved, more or less. All of them have the same pallid flesh, the red eyes, everything. They are 100% in this wheelhouse. What I think is interesting about this whole ritual, though, is very specifically what it calls out that it needs as the fuel for it. And this is one of the things that earlier in the story, and you can call it like forced foreshadowing, whatever you want to, we are introduced to Nathanios's nephew. And here he's brought back. He's a paladin. He's a paladin of the light. He's captured. He's brought into the Undercity. And he is to be fuel for this, because the sacrifice is required for the ritual, flesh that is akin to your own. That's really interesting to me, because if this process requires flesh of its own, that means it's beyond the Death Knight ritual. It's beyond the other ones a little bit, because it needs something that is living as a catalyst.
Beyond might actually be the wrong word. Inferior might be the right word.
Is it, though?
Because the Death Knight ritual does not require that. The Death Knight ritual, you need to fuel it with your actions. So it might be better or it might be worse. It depends on how you look at it.
Or is it the price of fel?
I don't know, because I don't think there's any fel involved. It seems very much necromantic and not fel. Necromantic is shadow. But there's a lot of weirdness to this. I mean, necromancy is something that the Legion has had known about for years. I mean, obviously, otherwise the Lich King wouldn't exist. Necromancy is something that the Nathrezim, who, as we know, are masters of shadow magic, love. The Nathrezim are over Necromancy.
They're akin to it, yeah.
So there's a lot of stuff here that we don't really know yet. We don't know if it's a better ritual or worse ritual, just a variation on it. We don't know where it comes from. One possibility here is that it's the Valkyr doing it. That means it might actually come from Helya.
Or Titan in general.
Well, Helya is the first Valkyr. And she developed a lot of the techniques even before she became the Valkyr. She was a master sorcerer. She was so good that she helped Ra make the elemental planes.
Right, but we also know that the Titans in general have the ability to essentially shove souls into living and non-living things.
Yeah.
I mean, theoretically, this could all stem from Titan ritualism as well.
Theoretically. But I mean, are we going to talk about that now, or are we going to just move on to talking about the story more?
Well, what I want to talk about here is actually it kind of ties into that, because they have a conversation. Nathanos and Sylvanas, they have like this little exchange when they're talking exactly about how this works. And Sylvanas, she said that Arthas once forced the Valkyr to raise Death Knights for his army, and that was a much more potent ritual than the one they're currently using to transform corpses into Forsaken. And she tells him, look, they can use their powers to reshape your body and make it stronger and more enduring. And he says, his immediate reaction is, well, couldn't they do this for everybody? And she says, no, because it's an arduous endeavor. It's one that they're reluctant to undertake. Without the Lich King's energies feeding them, I believe it requires a portion of their own essence to succeed. And he says, if the Valkyr can only do this once, why choose me? So the implication there is that this is a fairly involved thing that they're doing right now. And they can't just do it for everybody. They can't do it for all of the Forsaken and make them all look like humans.
We kind of seen that in the past, too, with the quest with like the multiple times that Sylvanas has died, where the Valkyr have sacrificed themselves to bring her back.
Yeah, it's also interesting to think about this, what it implies about Arthas and now Bolvar. Like, Arthas was putting out, they were getting the power from Arthas to do what they were doing. When they were raising Death Knights, they were getting the power from Arthas, which meant Arthas had that much power. Because he wasn't even
The Lich King was crazy powerful.
It's kind of obvious that when we beat him because he screwed up. Like, he could have taken us out, but he kept wanting to prove his point so badly. Like, the more I think about it, the implications for that, not that we're not talking about that today, but it's still there. There's a huge implication that the Lich King really could have just killed us and it would have been over.
I mean, heck, at one point during the fight, he did literally just kill the entire raid. Like, you die. It's not
He pretty much flat out says, yeah, the whole reason I brought you here, you guys came here just like I planned to have you here. You've been training to become stronger and stronger and stronger, and now you're the most powerful warriors that the other side has, which is great, because when I kill you and I raise you from the dead, you're going to be an awesome addition to my army.
And yeah, it's... Bolvar is scary.
Bolvar is, like, potentially probably one of the worst things ever, and we put him in that spot. But how could we not? Yeah. You know? If we didn't have the Lich King there on the throne, then the Scourge would just be running rampant all over the place.
And it makes me wonder, too, if there's been any hints about that, because I haven't played a Death Knight in Legion, and I haven't played a Death Knight campaign. Dude, so dude, I have no clue
what implications are there. I've been told I really need to play a Death Knight.
Yeah,
I have done the starting quests that took place in Ice Crown, and they are very good. And I recommend playing through those. Joe, you can make a trial account if you want to and just do it that way, and you don't have to like actually commit to leveling a Death Knight.
I have a Death Knight at the right level. I just haven't done it yet.
Oh, do then it. You should totally go do it.
Yeah, I'm going to just say this as somebody who leveled a Death Knight to 110. Yeah. The artifact stuff that comes in now too with 7.2 is even more like there's lots more scary implications. Yeah, the getting there's some stuff. Yeah.
You know what? Maybe we'll go ahead and talk about that next time, because I'd like to actually talk about what the Lich King is up to and what's going on with all of that. But that's kind of beside the point from this.
What a shock, we sidetracked a little.
Yeah. No kidding. So here's the deal. This ritual thing, it required a sacrifice. It required what they called fuel. And they brought in his nephew. They brought in his nephew who had lived out all of his dreams and accomplished everything that he wanted to accomplish when he was a little kid. He got to be a paladin and he fought and everything else. And now he gets to die so that Nathanos can go ahead and continue on. And the implication is there. After the ritual is completed, there is no body once the ritual is completed. There's just an implication that Nathanos is either using that body or that body has somehow been incorporated into his own. Because
I think the latter.
It says that he's looking in, when he looks into the mirror, he sees somebody who's not quite him looking back.
Yeah, and it makes me seem like, or at least I would feel, that if it's anything similar to the way that Death Knights were formed is, don't forget, the original Death Knights were not souls put back into their own bodies. They were other souls put into the bodies of humans. Like, it was not the right body for the right inside, so to speak. So, I mean, it totally could be, at least to me, because they never specified, like, when they get up and they say that they look at the, you know, the altar of ash, they never specify which altar he got up
from. No, you're wrong. They do, because Nathanos is still wearing the same clothes that he was when he was just a rotting forsake.
Oh, it says, you know, as he's looking into the mirror there, it says, then it struck him that the visage he looked upon was not entirely his own. He turned towards the second ritual table, empty save for a bit of ash and a few stains of oily residue. The paladin's armaments, once diligently polished, lay scuffed and strewn about the floor. Nathanos told himself they were merely the detritus of a fallen enemy, only that and nothing more.
Yeah. Nathanos is still wearing the rotting
clothes. I'm just wondering if
they,
like, hacked off body parts and gave them to Nathanos. Like, there's no...
I think, based on the way it works, just my reading of it, it felt more like he literally went up in smoke. Like, they disintegrated him and used him to rebuild Nathanos. So I think it's like he incorporated the body. That's how it felt. I don't think they just chopped him up and stuck him on to Nathanos.
I don't know. It when they started the ritual, it just said Nathanos' world exploded in a cacophony of fire and pain. So much pain. And you know, when it stops and it's all over with, all of a sudden he's wearing a face that doesn't look quite like his, almost, but not quite, maybe. So there's one other thing here that's kind of interesting to me. At the very end of the story here, he's like, he's getting new armor for himself. He's picking out new armor. He's not wearing the old ratty stuff that he's been wearing forever. And at the very last part of the story, he's turning to leave, and all of a sudden he notices like the glint of lamplight on like polished metal or whatever, and he sees this finely wrought breastplate that was clean, it was well maintained and everything else. And then he's thinking back to this ritual thing, and for just the tiniest moment there, like the tiniest second, he feels regret, something beyond the rage or the grumpiness or the anything else. That he actually feels a real emotion.
The grumpiness.
It's like a real emotion, a real mortal emotion. And Forsaken don't feel that kind of thing very often at all.
Well, I think that's part of the process too, is the fact that he's like a super Forsaken now. Like you said, he was much more like Sylvanas. And Sylvanas has that problem too, where she can feel a lot more than most Forsaken. Like when we read War Crimes, I think that we both commented on it. Sylvanas goes from emotional extreme to emotional extreme, and the through line is that she's constantly trying to repress it or telling herself, I don't feel these things because I'm dead, and then goes out and feels them. Like that's, Sylvanas can feel a lot more than the average Forsaken. There was a quest a long time ago, back when you'd first do the original version of Silverpine, where a Forsaken gives you a ring to put on her like father's grave and talks about how the only thing she can feel for him now is hate that he didn't stop this from happening to her. Like all the other emotions are gone. She just doesn't even have them.
Isn't that that quest that you picked up in Thunder Bluff and then you had to go all the way to...
Yeah, you had to go to from Thunder Bluff to Silver Pine.
Okay.
Because she's like in the what do they call those caves in Thunder Bluff? The Pools of Wisdom or something?
Pools of Vision or something?
Pools of Vision.
Yeah, and she sends you all the way back there and she's like, I know that I loved him, but I don't remember it. Like she knows that it was there, but she doesn't feel it. Most Forsaken don't feel anything or feel very distantly for their old lives. They know that they were there, but they don't, it's not visceral.
It makes sense, because if you're raising an army of the dead, so to speak, like these are remnants of their free will that is coming back to them after they were shackled to the Lich King, right? Even new ones are sort of an imperfect process, and they've called it out as much a couple times. So when you have beings that had free will that were then stifled in death, or on life, whatever you want to call it, and then given pieces of it back, I'm sure that a lot of that is suppressed, that a lot of that is just like that wiring has been broken purposely. Like, and maybe Sylvanas doesn't understand that completely with the regular Forsaken, or maybe now she does, now that she's capable of feeling so much more. And I like the idea of calling them super Forsaken, because it kind of fits, because they're more intact than the rotting corpses that are walking around in this new life, this new unlife. So they're more closer to the living than the others.
I think there's like even a little bit of that in the story when Nathanos and Sylvanas are first talking about what he looks like now. He says something like, you know, how do I look? And he tried to make it sound like it meant nothing, but it did mean something to how she felt about it. And
oh, yeah.
When she smiles, he's trying to figure out how she feels. And he's like, is it just pride that she has a new tool, or is it something more? Like, he didn't used to care. Like, he didn't care what her motivations were. He just obeyed her because she was the lich, you know, she was the Banshee Queen, and he was her champion. He obeyed her.
And there's
she
more
broke
of that
him
too.
Out of it. And it's, yeah, there's a lot of it in the story. It definitely feels like he's changed in terms of his motivations for following her are a lot deeper now.
And you see some of that too, like with when they're walking to the armory and Anya is making comments, like he loses
Anya's
his
a dark
temper.
Ranger.
She's a Dark Ranger, yes. But they're making comments about why Sylvanas did this, and they know they're snickering like, you know, teenagers about like, oh, look, you know, our sister, whatever you want to call her, has found, you know, her new love. And that's why she went through all this trouble. That's why she did all this.
Yeah, I kind of want to read that exchange, because she says, Anya, she says, yes, the queen now has a mightier champion, but that wasn't what she most desired. He stopped walking and faced her. Nathanos narrowed his eyes, infuriated by her invasiveness. Say what you mean. The corners of Anya's lips rose in a brazen curl. Sylvanas defied a kingdom to name you Ranger Lord. She scoured the plague lands to reclaim you from the scourge. And today, she drew upon her most precious resource, a.k.a. the Valkyr, to restore your strength. Think upon these things, Blightcaller, and tell me how someone so cunning can be blind to the simplest of truths.
And that's a very elven way to do that.
Mm-hmm.
Which is no wonder it would tick him off.
Oh, yeah.
It's exactly what he hated when he was human and living among elves. It was the whole reason he decided to go back to the Mara's Stead, because he could not handle the snide, sideways, not quite saying what you mean. Even when she's being direct, she's not being direct. Like, that was her direct response, and she still didn't say she loves you or she wants you or anything like that. She still played a game with him. Like, that's elven directness. No wonder.
And all he did was glare her down. He just glared her down because, as far as Nathanos is concerned, it's the Banshee Queen. She doesn't sit there frippering about and going, oh, I'm so in love or whatever. No, she's the Banshee Queen. And he doesn't do it either because the only thing in his heart is rage and contempt. He's her champion, and that's it.
Yeah. I don't know that I agree with that. I think that
that's what he's telling himself in the story.
That's what he's telling himself. But the fact that he feels the I don't want to say despair, but I don't know what you'd call it, regret. The fact that he feels that implies that he feels more than that.
That's the thing. And that's the part that kind of sticks with me there is because he's talking about all I feel is rage and contempt. I'm just her champion. Nothing more. And then as he's thinking about it, you know, he has that moment where he feels regret. And the regret could be on several different levels. It could be regret that his nephew had to be sacrificed for him to become what he is now, you know, so that he had this face worth looking at in the mirror. It could be regret that it can't be more than him being her champion because there's nothing else there. There's a lot of different levels to what that can be. Their relationship is really interesting. And it's interesting even beyond this story, because obviously this all takes place prior to Legion. When Sylvanas is named War Chief, he's there at Vol'jin's pyre, and the banter between the two of them, like, people were talking about it when they first ran into it. In the whole pre-expansion event, because the banter between Nathanos and Sylvanas was very flirtatious. It felt that it was like two dead people flirting, but they were flirting, right?
Yeah, I don't know if I'd call it. It's not. It is flirtatious, but it's very almost. It's almost Dave and Maddie from Moonlighting, and boy, I dated
There's
myself.
Banter.
Just now.
It's very bantering.
It's sort of like if you accept that Legolas and Gimli are bantering kind of flirtatiously. It's like that.
There's more to it too. Like it's like, look at the whole Stormheim, like, series of intro quests, at least from the Horde side. Like, Nathanos will burn the world to the ground to find her. Like, it's not an idle thing. It's not an, oh, we have to get our queen back. It's, I will burn and murder every single living thing between me and her to get her back. And it's not the same thing that we've seen from other missing dignitaries, or, you know, even when Varian was missing, there wasn't a whole lot of, okay, let's just wage war every which way we can until we get him back. But with him, he's willing to expend every single one of his resources, call in reinforcements, do what he has to do to find her. And every step away in that quest, as you're finding, like, the symbols of her sort of wrecking her way through Stormheim, her swords, her arrows, signs of her in combat, things like that. When Nathanos comes up and verifies that this belongs to her, it's this, you know, these moments of voice acting or presentation of slightly somber, thoughtful, back to anger, but not anger at, like, what's happened, the anger that she's not there with him and that he almost feels like he failed her because she potentially came to some harm. And it's not like the royal protector, oh, you know, I failed in my duty. It's the, oh no, the person or the thing that I love most in this world is possibly going to be harmed because I couldn't do my job.
It feels strange to call it love,
but it is.
I'm not saying it isn't. What I'm just saying is it feels strange to call it love because that makes it almost sound like they're still going to do every horrible, murderous thing they were going to do.
Oh, yeah, they absolutely are.
And it's so fascinating to watch in terms of it. This is not like it's like two people that you know absolutely that they are doomed no matter what happens, they are literally damned. Like, this is not going to end well.
You know, and this is one of those weird things where I will liken this to an older movie, too. It's almost like Natural Born Killers. Yes, these two people are going to do absolutely horrible, wretched things. But in the microcosm of their own interactions, they love each other. And like it's and I'm not saying that as a matter of projection. It's like the way that they care about each other, the lengths that they will go through for each other transcends other relationships in this game. And like between NPCs that we've seen, like it might even be more obsessive or more involved than like I don't know, like any of the Alliance NPCs we've seen that are like, these are actually married couples that like one or the other goes missing. But it's like there's more weight to it is what I'm trying to say. Right. Like,
I want to go back to this. I want to go back to this in a bit. But before we do, we did get an email regarding the ritual that went on with Dark Mirror. And I feel like we should address that email. And then we're going to go ahead and go back to this because I do have I have a question and an observation to pose to the both of you. But first off, we've got an email from Lythos, who's a dwarf warrior on Duritan US, who says, "Hi Watchers, Lythos, proud dwarf warrior of Duritan US and Patreon supporter here. I've been ruminating over the Dark Mirror short story for a day or so now, and I've come to a conclusion that I want your opinion on. It seems to me that an argument can be made for the idea that Death Knights are in fact a corrupted version of the storm forging process that Odin uses. I've seen him transform dead Vrykul into Stormforged. We've seen his Valkyr do the same. With the revelation on Sylvanas' Valkyr being able to essentially reforge the dead into new, stronger forms in a variant of the Death Knight ritual, I now figure that the ability to create Valkyr is something that the Lich King was infused with or taught to Ner'zhul's spirit as part of the process that turned him into the Lich King. This would make Death Knights almost a corrupted Titan Forged. Just something I've been pondering for a bit. Keep up the good work and have fun, folks." What do you guys think as far as like the relationship, the implied relationship here between...
Well, I think you're leaving... Well, I mean, you want to go first or I'll let you go first?
Yeah, this is something that I've actually thought about. When I talked to you like years ago about the story about the Hearthstone and everything like that, this actually kind of is part of that as well. Because I've always been curious about this because this isn't the only ritual that puts a spirit back in the body, and not even in game terms. We have druids have rebirth. Shaman can resurrect themselves. You have the basic resurrections that all the healers can cast. You have the mass resurrections that healers can cast. And you can argue that those are light things, but is it really any different? Because you're shoving a soul back into a body. And as players, too, when we die out in the world, we don't die. We go, what do? We go back to our bodies and jump back in the corpse. Like, we're not just reborn. We're not just magically, oh, new bodies constructed. We're literally putting ourselves back into our fallen form. And it interests me because this isn't just a unique concept to the Stormforged, the Titanforged, the Death Knights. This is something that's been around since day one. And I'm very, very curious about if all of this comes from the same root sources, is if everything that's here comes from this weird mix of being at the middle of all of these planes of existence that, you know, maybe Death Knights are just a perverted version of the Shaman Resurrection, or maybe that's all just a perverted version of creating of the Titan Forged. Or because, I mean, here's the thing. I understand the Titans are arcane in order, but they know about the other things. You can't have infinite knowledge and not understand how to manipulate different forces. You may choose not to, but you at least have somewhat of an understanding of it. Maybe this is all tied together. My two cents.
I was doing some research the other day. One of the things that it says in Chronicle, Odin with the Y sacrificed his eye to see into the Shadowlands, the realm of death, and learn how to make the Valkyr. So that's not from the Titans. He had to go to the Shadowlands and rip out his eye and trade. And here's a question. Who did he trade the eye to?
Mm-hmm.
I don't know the answer to that question. Chronicle doesn't say. But that's not knowledge that he got from the Titans. That's knowledge he got from the Shadowlands. Helya would have that knowledge because he made Helya the first Valkyr. And she wasn't just any Valkyr.
She exists on the edge of the Shadowlands anyway, right?
Well, she does now. I mean, she did now. If she's actually dead, I don't know. But the whole point was she was more than Aeir is. Aeir is the current head of the Valkyr, and she's like a kind of a demigoddess. Helya was more advanced than that, obviously, since Helya gave Sylvanas a lantern that could control Aeir, which means she understands the Valkyr ritual better than Aeir does, if she can create a device that can control the head of the Valkyr. Helya was already a better sorcerer than Odin, because she was the one that put the Halls of Valor up in the first place. He didn't do that himself. He had her do it. She was so good at creating all pocket planes of existence that when they created the elemental planes to imprison the elementals following, you know, when they were ordering the world, Master Ra said, "Hey, Odin, can I borrow your daughter? Because I need somebody that good so I can get this place locked up properly." And he was like, "Okay." And that's where that comes from. So I don't think this is something that the Titans came up with. I don't think it's akin to the Curse of Flesh. The Stormforge thing is basically using that kind of stolen ritual that he got from the Shadowlands to put spirits in Titanforge bodies. These are the bodies are Titanforged. Mm-hmm. I don't think that that's the ritual just seems separate from that. So I don't think it's a case of.
Well, the reason
what I'm trying to say is that the Stormforge themselves, the bodies are immaterial. The fact that he's putting the bodies in inorganic body, you know, the Titans know how to do that kind of thing because that's what the Mogu sure. do. The Mogu do that all the time. They put their bodies in stone. They put their spirits in stone bodies. That's how they get around the Curse of Flesh. The question is, do the Valkyr know how to do this because Helya knew how to do it because Odin gave her that knowledge? Because he would have gotten it when he ripped out his eye. That's in Chronicle. He sacrificed his eye to see into the Shadowlands and learn how to create his new army.
And that it would was make part sense. And it would make sense that he would teach her because that was her task, right? He wanted her to be the first of the Valkyr and then create more.
Then you have the problem of the Lich King's involvement. Like, because the Lich King is Ner'zhul originally. The first Lich King was Ner'zhul. And Arthas, as the Lich King, had all of Ner'zhul's knowledge of necromancy, which was pretty extensive because Ner'zhul, as we saw from the alternate Ner'zhul, the Shadowmoon clan knew a lot about necromancy. Because they'd been studying a void lore, you know, they were studying, a fallen Naru. They were studying its shadow magic for, you know, however long. They weren't supposed to use that ability. The one from the alternate Draenor did, but our Ner'zhul didn't, at least until, you know,
they
he was shoved into.
They were familiar enough with the void to know that they should be avoiding it.
Yeah, and there's a lot going on here. Like, did Arthas give them Ner'zhul's knowledge? Is it Ner'zhul's knowledge that Gul'dan used to create Death Knights? Because he couldn't use spell power for that.
Well, here's my question, that's what I was... right?
Okay.
Okay, so when Ner'zhul was created into the Lich King, right? When Kil'jaeden transformed him, what happened there was that Ner'zhul, he hopped a portal to get off of Draenor when Draenor was being shattered. And Kil'jaeden intercepted him and said, yeah, no, we're not done with you yet, and tore his body to pieces until just his spirit was left, basically tortured him, and then encased him in the block of ice, and he became the Lich King and all of this. Where was that portal to? The portal that he hopped to? More importantly, was the Lich King originally Ner'zhul, or was it some other kind of spirit or entity that Ner'zhul's spirit was bound to?
Or was it the Helm of Domination and the armor and the sword? Were those created to house his spirit?
What if he hopped a portal and ended up in the Shadowlands?
Maybe. And for that matter, what if the various tools they used to house the Lich King's spirit were effectively his version of a Stormforge body? Instead of him in a robot body, they stuck him in those items.
Yeah, I had a question in the queue over the weekend. I think it was over the weekend. This weekend here, where somebody was talking about the relation between whether there was a relation between what was going on with the Valkyr raising dead and the Death Knights, and what happened with Kil'jaeden and Ner'zhul becoming the Lich King, and whether or not he had had any contact with Helya over that, whether like she had given any input into that. And I'm like, well, why would that wouldn't even come into play here, because Kil'jaeden wasn't involved with Azeroth at all at the time. And Helya was very much an Azeroth entity. So what you're looking at here is Kil'jaeden found Ner'zhul, made him this thing that had dominion over death or whatever, and sent him to Azeroth. And then, yeah, they probably, you know, butted heads or at the very least contradicted each other, because Helya has her Valkyr, right? The Lich King showed up and he basically commandeered her Valkyr. He stole them. And then he started creating more.
But did he steal them from her, or did he steal Odin's?
That's a good question.
And we don't know, right? Like, because they could have come from anywhere.
Yeah, we know that.
Have the answer to that one, do we?
No. Well, no. There's that village in bloody heck, I don't remember if it's in Ice Crown. I think it's on the edge of Ice Crown. There's a Vrykul village where they're training up new Valkyr.
Yeah, it's up in the Storm Peaks.
We don't know if the traditions of those guys were from Odin or from Helya, because we don't really know much about it. We just remember that they're there.
And it could have been either, right? Because, I mean, the Halls of Valor were once associated with Alduar, and where's Alduar? Yeah.
And there's two different villages there. There's the one where they're fighting to, like, you know, ascend and all this other stuff. And then there's this other village where they want to become the Lich King's Valkyr. they want the Lich King to transform them into Valkyr.
Yeah. So it's
it, like the one village almost seems like it's the tradition of Aer, right? Because like even and now that you're mentioning that, there's a lot of similarities between them and then the village that's right below the Halls of Valor, right where Aer resides, where all of her priestesses right. are. Like there's the bear riding trials of strength. It's the exact same thing that they were doing in the Storm Peaks. So I'm wondering if
they were
maybe
trying
that
to gain
was a
Thorim's favor, weren't they?
Yeah, it was Thorim's favor.
Yeah, they're trying to get Thorin's favor because Thorin was the one who was there.
Right.
Oh, they couldn't reach Odin.
No, because he was gone.
And it's weird, too, because we know that Odin considers Thorin his son. And they're all Titanforged. See, that's an odd thing. Why is Thorin Odin's son? Much in the same way that he thinks of Helya as his daughter. He calls Helya his daughter at one point.
But I think that has to be the whole, like, I am the greatest, I am in charge of everything, that makes me the father of this group type thing.
Yeah, but it's still interesting that you have these
figures. I'm the dad of all of you. You have to make me
proud. I even have
Gadgar's
voice. But no, it's interesting to think of the ways these things are, like,
intertwined. And yeah, that's what I was trying to hint at earlier, is because there's so many things that do similar things. Like, I'm wondering where the true originating point of it was. Everything seems like its own different flavor of the same ritual, almost.
Well, that's interesting, too, with the Nathanos thing. The way I read it is that Nathanos' spirit wasn't put in his nephew's body, because his nephew's armor is blackened and destroyed, and Nathanos' body is still in his original rotted clothing. So it's like they basically did it in verse. Instead of putting Nathanos' spirit inside of a new living body, they essentially killed the living person and jammed all that was left of him into Nathanos. Whether they did it the way Anne suggested or they just magically, like, you know, ripped him apart.
It's like they merged them together like a Reese's peanut butter cup, only we don't know which one is the chocolate and which one is the peanut butter.
You got my chocolate and my peanut butter.
You got my Nathanos and his nephew. You got his nephew and... No, that sounds really bad. I'm just going to stop that train of thought right there, but... Regardless, the point stands.
It reminds me of the way Ner'zhul was turned into the Lich King, though. Because he even says when Kil'jaeden got his hands on him, he slowly tore him apart.
Yeah, he tore his body to shreds and then took his spirit and, like, slapped it in the Helm of Domination and all of that, encased it in this rock-hard diamond ice, and then set that on Azeroth and said, here you go, do some stuff for us. And Ner'zhul had, I don't think he ever really wanted to work for Kil'jaeden, because like the entire time that he was on Azeroth, what was he doing? He was trying to break free, and he was just doing it really subtly. And by the time the Burning Legion realized what the Lich King was doing, it was almost too late to do anything about it. And, you know, they tried their best. They got Illidan Stormrage and kind of threw him there and said, take care of this problem. And even Illidan couldn't take care of the problem at that point. He'd gotten too strong. Lythos, I don't know if this addresses your question exactly, but man, we have a lot of things to think about, don't we? Because we do. Because I'm kind of curious now, and I feel like it all kind of ties into the Lich King was created.
You know what else it ties into? The still yet as yet unexplained deal between Helya and Sylvanas.
Yeah, and
we still don't know the details of that.
No, we don't. And I do want to go back to that. But before I go back to that, there was something else I wanted to say. And I don't know if I'm going to remember it. Oh, okay. So we still don't know how the Lich King was created. We don't know exactly what that process was. That wasn't covered in Chronicle Volume 2. Because it's Third War stuff. And I have a feeling that if we get Chronicle Volume 3 out here, maybe that'll answer a lot of these questions. Because we'll have a little more clarification, at the very least, on what goes on. And maybe some of those weird implied relationships between all these different rituals and the different ways of doing things will be clarified. Now, I want to go back to the subject of love, because let's talk about love. More specifically, let's talk about Sylvanas and Nathanos. I find the timing of this very interesting for one specific reason. If you read War Crimes, the entirety of War Crimes is basically the adventures of Varisa and Sylvanas rekindling their relationship with each other, rekindling that sisterly bond to the point where Varisa was even considering going to live with Sylvanas in the Undercity. And at the end, she backed out of it. And there's this terrific, there's this beautiful scene of Sylvanas running through the forest, just randomly killing any wildlife or creatures that happened to get in her way, and having a fit and swearing to herself that she would never, ever, ever attempt to love again. Because obviously, you know, when that whole thing was going on throughout War Crimes, one of the implications there was that Sylvanas was beginning to feel again. She was beginning to feel what it felt like to you know, have that kind of familial love with your relatives and that kind of that sisterly bond. And that was broken. And she told herself very, like, absolute at the end of that novel that she'd never attempt to love again. So then we get to Warlords of Draenor, and she doesn't really do too much in Warlords of Draenor. We don't see her very much at all. She's biding her time on Azeroth doing some other stuff. And then we get to Dark Mirror, which is after Warlords, so a year or so later. And that's when she decides to do this with Nathanos. Despite the fact that she knew about this ability that the Valkyr had, like, all the way back, I mean, obviously she knew about it when she died and she was resurrected. She knew about it back then. She knew that they were capable of this thing. She didn't think about implementing it. She didn't think about doing this with Nathanos until just now. Do we think that maybe the events of War Crimes and what she experienced in War Crimes had some kind of influence or effect, or maybe that was the reasoning for her decision to do this now, or was there a different reason for it? What do you guys think?
Honestly, I think it's very possible that what she went through with Varisa might have pushed her into doing this, because I think, you know, I don't know how to put this properly. Who's the one person she will never have to lose?
Nathanos, because he's dead already. Yeah.
And more importantly, will he leave? No.
No, he's utterly devoted.
If anybody has proved he isn't going anywhere, it's Nathanos. Nathanos has straight up proved that he is loyal to a fault, to his own detriment. He is loyal. He isn't going anywhere. He's safe. Do you know what I'm saying?
And it fits with the comments of the story too. Like when we're just talking about it with Anya and the Dark Rangers, when they're talking about it, it's that statement rings true. Think about all these things and understand the truth of it. Yeah, I mean, she desires what does she desire most in this entire world? And we saw this with her trying to convert her sister, companionship. She needs somebody at her level. She doesn't have that. Now she does.
And the thing is, with her sister, the way that went, it was very much, it was a very twisted form of love, in that she was going to murder her sister in her sleep.
So that her sister would stay by her side forever.
Yes. She was going to kill her, you know, and she'd do it when she was unconscious. She didn't want to hurt Varisa. You know, it was going to be much better than when she came over, because Sylvanas' was horrifying. Sylvanas was murdered by the Lich King slowly, and then he ripped her soul out of death. And again, he didn't, when he did it, he wasn't Lich King yet. He was a Death Knight. He didn't put her soul back in her body. He twisted it and made it a banshee. She did that. She went and found her body and
got
it back.
She had to reclaim her body herself.
Yeah. So her experience was horrifying. And you see it with both Nathanos and her sister. Nathanos' wasn't pleasant. It was incredibly painful. But compared to what Sylvanas went through, it was nothing. She wants it to be better for the people she cares about. She just has no ability to think like a living person anymore. She can't think, wait, maybe they don't want to be grotesque, evil, magic, animated corpses for eternity.
And despite the horrifying thing that she wants to do to Varisa, and despite the anger that she felt at the end of the novel, the points where she was feeling, all of a sudden she was feeling that love again, were pleasant. They were weirdly pleasant. It was a feeling that she hadn't experienced in forever.
I don't even think it's in spite of. I think it's because of.
Yeah.
Like, I think it's directly related. Sylvanas, if you know, it was an expression of love. She's like, she's like, she meets Varys again and she's expecting it to be horrible. And halfway through in War Crimes, Varys's like halfway through their first meeting, Varys says something and Sylvanas like smirks. And it's like, she almost, you can almost feel the way the story is written. You can almost feel like herself, she makes an expression and then like her face twitches. And she's like, what did I just do? There's a whole part where she talks like it's like a phantom limb. I remember that's the exact phrase she uses. It's like a phantom limb. Like I shouldn't be able to feel this. Like,
and yet she can.
Yeah. And I don't think that's why I think the bit in the end where Nathanos feels regret, I think they don't understand how alive they are, because they are dead, but
they're not quite. He even says that when she asks how he feels, dead, but not quite so. Right. Like,
yeah,
it's this weird kind of in between. And it's an in between where all of a sudden he's noticing things like how the dead people in Undercity smell.
Yeah.
You know, all of a sudden he's cognizant of these things that he wasn't really cognizant of before as a Forsaken. It's like a halfway awakening of sorts.
The curse of the super Forsaken.
And the funny part, well, not the funny part, not haha funny, but just interesting funny, is that what she wanted to do to Varysa was bring her down to that level from a living creature. What she wanted to do with Nathanos was elevate him up from Forsaken to that creature. Mm-hmm. And she got what she wanted out of Nathanos. But did she really want it from Nathanos, or was this just her way of trying to get that thing that she couldn't get from Varysa?
I don't think it's reductionist that way. I don't think that she's settling for him, but I think
she would have tried it anyway.
Yeah, but
even if she had gotten her sister, I think she would have done it.
Is it him that she wants, or is it that feeling?
Oh, it's both. I definitely think that feeling colors it, but it definitely is him, because there's a point where there's a point where he makes a very specific point. She went and got him when he was a rotting nothing, when he was literally so mindless that he could not stop eating a dead person. Like, when she showed up with her Dark Rangers to get him,
he was eating a woman. Yeah.
Yeah. And he basically just like, you know, did the Lich King send you to interrupt me? But he doesn't even say this. There's no words. He just hisses. And she goes, Nathanos. And then that's like, it hits him and he's like, what? And then she like basically banshee screams it at him. And that's what breaks him out of it. He is important. He isn't just a plaything. He isn't just a possession. He's important because of what he signifies. And I think that's why the story opens with them on the stead when they were both alive.
Mm-hmm.
Because he's like, it's that same thing when she sees Varysa again and she's like, what is this? And Nathanos has always symbolized that choice she made, that thing she did that nobody approved of.
Well, not only that, take it even a step further there. And this is something that is a common feeling among especially our type of people, our geeks out there. You have two types of family. You have the family you're born with and the family you choose. And Nathanos was very much a family she chose. Whether you want, however you want to define that, whether it's a simple companionship, love, whatever, she chose him. That is a sense of self to her, just like you're saying. So like, she has her sisters. She wanted her sisters. She has Nathanos. She wanted Nathanos. Like, what is existence if not derived meaning from the family around you? Or at least some otherly, overly poetic thing, whatever you want to insert here. But it's that moment that she's realizing that, yes, she's in this in-between phase. She's in this moment where she even talks about her people. Well, even the Forsaken technically aren't her people anymore. She's above that. Nathanos is her people. Like, that's, and even more so because he was once family to her, he's now family again. He's on the same level playing field that she is, at least biologically at this point now too. And I think that's kind of an important distinction where it's like, for lack of a better term, her humanity is sort of creeping back in.
Okay, well, we don't really know what's going to happen to Azeroth's oddest couple ever, but it's certainly interesting to talk about. They're cute in a really weird, dark kind of way.
Harold and Maude.
if you're interested in reading it, Dark Mirror is available for free on Blizzard's website. You can go read it now. It's a fairly short story, but the implications that it kind of leaves behind and makes, particularly in conjunction with everything that we read in War Crimes, is really interesting, and you should definitely go give it a read if you haven't. Blizzard Watch is made possible due to the generous contributions at patreon.com/blizzardwatch, and your continued support means that this podcast site and community is able to thrive and grow. Blizzard Watch supporters enjoy exclusive benefits like early access to the podcast, a better chance at having your questions answered on our podcast or the queue, and an ads-free site experience. And for you guys, if you're interested, I know we talked about War Crimes quite a bit here. There is an audio version of War Crimes available. For the listeners of Blizzard Watch, Audible is offering a free audiobook download with a free 30-day trial to give you the opportunity to check out their service. You can download War Crimes or any other title as part of that whole free download if you'd like. And all you have to do to get that is to go to blizzardwatch.com/audible and sign up for your free trial. So I have one more thing to mention to you guys, and I don't know, this might actually become a longer conversation without my meaning for it to be, but we have in Legion Sylvanas going to Stormheim specifically to make a deal with Hellia, get a lantern to try and control Aeir. I can't talk today.
Aeir,
yeah. Thank you. Anyway, she made a deal with Hellia, essentially, to get a lantern to go control this Valkyr for some purpose. Now, I want to know what you guys think that purpose is, but before you offer your suggestions, I'm going to offer my own, or at least suggest something. In this short story, they talk about how the Valkyr of the Lich King were able to sustain themselves off of the energies of the Lich King. I think that she's getting this lantern because she wants her Valkyr to do the same thing and have that same kind of symbiotic relationship where they're taking their energies from her.
Maybe. My thing is using
the lantern to subjugate her, you know, keep her in place so that they can simply feed and do what they need to.
You mean from Aeir?
Yes.
Yeah.
Okay, I thought you meant from her, from Sylvanas.
No, from Aeir.
She wants to kill herself?
No, not herself. She views Aeir on the same level as the Lich King, a source for energy, and that's what she was up to. But that's my theory on the subject, so what I want to know here, final question, is why do you think she made that bargain? What was her end game with getting that lantern and having that control? Joe, go ahead.
Resource expansion, but not in the same way. Because if you think about it, right, what's one of her driving goals? She's been looking for a way to preserve her race and to have their race propagate. The Forsaken, her people. If you take control of Aeir and put her in a place where you can make Aeir not exist anymore, you can force the other Valkyr, who theoretically have the same ability as Hellia's Valkyr and the Lich King's Valkyr, to basically force them to do your bidding, then you don't have to worry about expending your resources because you're expending somebody else's resources. Resources that are directly tied to Odin. Resources that are directly created from his titanic power. Hellia gets to keep her Valkyr, who now are no longer being used as batteries by Sylvanas. And at the same time, Hellia gets to hurt Odin. It's a win-win for both players involved. That's what I think it was. I don't think it was necessarily that Aeir was going to be the battery. Odin was going to be the unwitting battery.
Okay. Rossi, what do you think?
I think the ultimate plan was quite simple. Get control of Aeir through Aeir, get control of all the Odin's Valkyr, and make all Forsaken like herself and Nathanos.
Yep.
Make them the super Forsaken.
Yeah. So now they basically all like Death Knights. Because the Death Knight is so far superior to Forsaken. Even like the only Death Knights who even have any of the problems of Forsaken are the ones who were Forsaken before they became Death Knights. And even those guys, stuff's not falling off anymore. You know what I'm saying? Like there's...
Yeah.
They're not...
They're frozen in the state of decay that they were in when they were...
When they died the second time. Like, Forsaken Death Knights, man. Oh, yeah, I've died twice.
They died, like, doubly bad. They died twice.
Yeah. But, you know, in terms of, like, Death Knights, one of the things I've always thought interesting is, like, when you play them, Death Knights and Sylvanas have completely, they don't look like they're rotting at all. Like, there's no, like, stuff's not falling off. They're not decaying. And what does that say about their brains? Like, you know, their physical structure. Is it more intact? Is that why they can feel more? Is that why Death Knights have the whole suffer well thing? Because they have to keep inflicting that pain. They don't Sylvanas doesn't have to go around hurting people to stay what she is. So if she makes all Forsaken like that, now they're doing better, you know. So, and they'd be, you know, much harder to stop, quite frankly. So that's where I think that was going.
Okay. I still think we're probably going to learn more about this when Chronicle Volume 3 comes out. And I'm hoping that we see an announcement in regards to that at some point in the near future here. If you have any questions for us here on Lore Watch regarding this story or anything else, really, I think next time we're probably going to talk about Death Knights, because honestly, this is kind of an entertaining topic and I want to keep doing it. So yeah, if you have any questions for us, send those to podcast@blizzardwatch.com. Put Lore Watch in the subject line so that we know that it's intended for this show. Thanks very much for listening, guys, and we will see you in 2 weeks.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Hi, I'm Daniel, founder of Pretty Litter. Did you know cats tend to hide symptoms of sickness and pain? I learned this the hard way after losing my cat, Gingy. So I created Pretty Litter, a health monitoring litter that helps detect early signs of illness by changing colors, saving you money and potentially your cat's life. Pretty Litter is veterinarian developed, and it's the easiest way to keep tabs on your fur baby's health right at home.
Go to prettylitter.com and use code ACAST for 20% off your first order and a free cat toy. Terms and conditions apply. See site for details.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. warbyparker.com/covered.